You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for January 2023. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and a reader from Indianapolis. Today we'll be discussing one of the biggest and best-selling science fiction novels of 2022, Blake Crouch's Upgrade. Upgrade is set in a not-too-far-distant future America, which is kind of a surveillance state in which people are dealing not only with the ongoing effects of climate change, but also a disastrous worldwide famine that killed about 200 million people and that was caused by some well-intentioned gene tampering, let's just say. it's smart and it's fast-paced, and I'm betting that this discussion will be both. So let's get started and see who's in the clubhouse this month. We have four returning members of Radio Free Book Club, and I'd love to have them introduce themselves. Let's start with Steve.
Hi, Steve Woods. I'm a financial advisor and avid reader, and glad to be here again.
Thank you, Steve. Craig?
Craig Von Dalen. I am a father, a reader, a new uncle, and an architect, and just a dude.
Yeah, definitely a dude. Maybe the dude.
Maybe. No, I don't know about that.
Yes. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Ken. Hey, everyone. Christine Hudson here. This is my, I think, third appearance on the book club. Super excited to be here. This book was actually my pick, so if it falls flat, that's on me. Born and raised in Indianapolis, I am sort of a digital marketer by trade, but spend a lot of my spare time reading, cooking, sleeping, cycling, doing yoga.
Yeah.
And writing very long questions.
Yeah, you're good at all of them. Yeah, well, your questions are going to be a lot of fun to deal with, and we're going to get right to that. But just one more little note before we start the discussion. If you have any interest in reading Upgrade and you want to keep all the surprises surprising, this would be a good time to listen to something else. This is at Radio Free Book Club. We actually do talk about the book. There will be lots of spoilers in this discussion. But you can find this and all the episodes of Radio Free Book Club podcast on Mixcloud, Spotify, Apple, just about anywhere you stream podcasts. So read Upgrade, come back and listen. And Christine, this was your selection.
Yeah.
So you get to go first. Why did you choose it? And what did you think of it?
Sure. So I chose this book because Blake Crouch's past two books, or most recent past two books, Recursion and Dark Matter, were like books that I can't stop thinking about. And so I tried to read his earlier work, but it was just not quite as good. So I was super excited for Upgrade, which is his first release since Dark Matter, which the year that Dark Matter came out, I think it was 2020, one of my favorite books of that year. And super excited for Upgrade. I think I got this in July. And I've been saving it for like just the right time. So I was excited to dig in. My expectations were very, very high for this book. And I feel like the book met my expectations in terms of what I typically expect from Blake Crouch, which is something thought-provoking, but also kind of like, I've been calling it like bro sci-fi. So like not super nerdy, much more character than science-driven, but still really entertaining and fast-paced and fun. I think this book did that well, maybe almost too well. I think at times it felt like a Marvel movie. I was like, wait, what am I reading? Is this a screenplay for like the next Marvel movie? But I think that one thing that this book did really well was it was still thought-provoking and probing and intriguing, but also felt like reading an action movie screenplay. So a super fun read, I think, for the holidays especially, because I think this was set around Christmas in whatever year this happens. So overall, I liked it. I think it's I think one thing that Crouch does well is he writes big books about small themes. Well, not small themes. Like, I think this book was mostly about human nature, to boil it down to, like, the simplest terms. But the way that he extrapolates that is always really good and fascinating and takes a lot of twists and turns. Definitely a page-turner.
Yeah. I'll say more, but I mean, cinematic was one of the words I used. It was felt very much, as you said to me, felt very much like a movie script. Steve Woods, what do you think?
I liked it. I'm not a huge sci-fi fan. I knew that Craig would really like this based on our last book that we had read. But, you know, kind of one of the litmus tests is, am I excited about picking it up or is this a slog? And I did rip through this quickly, and I found that when I wasn't reading it, I was thinking about it. And I do agree with Christine that there were a lot of kind of heavyweight ideas that you don't find in a lot of science fiction, in my opinion. And I was hooked. I liked it, and I'm looking forward to kind of diving into this.
Yeah. Craig, are you going to make it three in a row?
I loved this book for part one. I became ambivalent in part two, and I got really frustrated and tired of it in part three. The first part of it where he first became aware of his genome being changed was, and the way he described it was very interesting and very oddly engaging. And then as it went on, it just became more and more to me contrived. Especially towards the end, it's like, really? Okay, her lab is in Manhattan, yada, yada, yada. There's 6 feet of water in lower Manhattan. That's kind of a little out there because, I mean, then I went and I do research whenever I'm reading books. The projected, even in worst case scenario, projected increase in water levels of the Atlantic Ocean is like 12 inches over the next 30 years. So really, would lower Manhattan be under 6 feet of water? It just seemed like a weird, like, okay, let's construct a situation where we have to go into a high-rise tower that's 6 feet underwater on the first floor. That was not as interesting to me as the beginning of the book where he was experiencing these changes within his own body and his own psyche that I found deeply interesting. And it just, he sort of like threw the rest of the book together to finish the thing off.
So it was kind of the action movie nature of it that kind of turned you off to it.
Yeah. I mean, it just didn't, it didn't play well with the beginning, which was really thought provoking.
Yeah.
And I like thought provoking and I love sci-fi, but I want it to be a little more thoughtful as you go through. And then the other part of it is, can we just have a sci-fi book that's not so down on the future? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, oh my God, the world's going to be, the human race is going to be extinct in 100 years. I mean, come on. Is it really, is it that bad?
You know,
I don't think it's that bad.
I almost recommended one for my recommendation that's coming up at the end of the show, but I didn't. But I'll tell you about what it is after the show. I did like it, I would have to say. This is going to sound like super snobby, but most of what I read is more literary novels. And it's sometimes hard for me to shift into this kind of, what's really kind of an action-adventure novel. I mean, even most of the science fiction, and I read a fair amount of science fiction, but even most of that is more kind of literary type science fiction than this is. But I have to say, I thought it was really well paced. I think sometimes this kind of science fiction can have really bad info dumps where characters are telling each other things that they already know just so, you know, the reader can hear them. I didn't find a lot of that there. I loved a couple of specific things like that whole idea of encoding the message in the DNA. I thought that was really clever. You know, there's some things, sort of some more formal things that bug me. All the one-sentence paragraphs bug me. I mean, it was just like page after page, as if that is exactly what you needed to kind of accelerate the action, which, I mean, it has that effect, but maybe if you have to do it that way, maybe there are better ways to do it. There are some plot things that kind of bug me, like Logan's getting infected. Man, Miriam was very lucky that they were the team that arrested that dude that went to the place.
Right.
And he was the only one who got hit by the very ingenious method of the ice fragments infecting him.
Right.
Yeah, why couldn't she just send a drone?
Well,
action.
So she did,
action
right?
Movie, you know?
Right.
Got to get that explosion in.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like, Ken, I agree. I think that this book, if you swap out Logan, who was, what, maybe in his late 30s, early 40s. Mm-hmm. If you swap him out for like a 16-year-old, this could have been a YA novel, mm-hmm. at least like that, which not to knock it, nothing wrong with YA. But yeah, it's definitely the style of writing, even down to like the one sentence paragraph and some of the word choice and like plot mechanisms are just like, okay, I could, yeah, this could just, this could be a YA novel for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, I think we all agree that the premise is interesting, right? And that, and there is some thought-provoking stuff there. And part of it, you know, one of the things I was thinking also was that, are you, any of you, all of you familiar with Peter Singer, the philosopher? He's a modern philosopher. I think his big book was Animal Liberation. In any case, he told a story of, you know, you're walking through a park early in the morning, you're wearing these super expensive Italian shoes that you just bought, and you find a baby who's drowning in a fountain and no one else is around. There's no time to do anything. Will you step into that fountain in those very expensive Italian shoes? Of course you will. You would not hesitate to do that, to ruin your shoes to save that baby. Well, there are tens of thousands of children dying of hunger every day in the world. Okay, now what are you going to do? So as you know, as the number of people affected by the horrible thing goes up, mm-hmm. our compassion level, we have an ability to turn that off.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something exactly like that said in the book where, like, evolutionarily mm-hmm. speaking, we can have compassion for our immediate group of people and, like, maybe their people, which I think in the book, it was said to be, like, 150. Anything beyond that, it's just faceless, like, oh, well, you know, it feels so far away that I can't do anything, so...
Yeah, and that's a number that's actually quoted by another one of the epigrams in here was Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote, now I'm going to forget, Sapiens is the book, mm-hmm. who also uses that same statistic yeah. that you can care about 150 people and you can kind of control that society without a lot of infrastructure because everybody knows everybody. But once you get past that number, you start getting all kinds of problems that need other kinds of control.
Yeah.
But that's like, to me, that's a cop-out and an excuse. That I don't really think that our society is that bad, that we're going to turn our back on 10,000 starving children because they're not in the 150 people we care about. And I think that's sort of like a... I get it. I understand it. And it makes logical sense. But I think we still deeply care about when children are dying, whether they're associated with us or not. And I think as a society, we still deeply care about when children are dying. And in saying that that's going to be the end of our civilization because that relic of evolutionary biology continues to exist in our psyche is sort of a cop-out. And yeah, it's an interesting premise for a book, but I really want to get to a point where we can have some sci-fi where the future is actually not post-apocalyptic or pre-post-apocalyptic mm-hmm. in nature. I mean, I don't think it's going to be that bad in 40 years. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'd like to think that I'm right. So that's the part that just bugs me. I want a more of a Star Trek-y approach to science fiction in the future than this constant like banging of a gong of the world is coming to a close and humanity is on its way out the door. In my reading, I'm just done with it.
No, I gotcha. I mean, I found, and I know you did a little research, and I think that's awesome, Craig. I found the future, it felt sort of plausible to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. How did that feel to you, Steve?
I didn't have a problem with that. I could envision it. I remember our conversation on, was it the Glass Hotel, that Emily St. John Mandel, where she provided... information on technology, but didn't step back and describe it.
Yeah, on Sea of Tranquility. And I was thinking about that, too. Yep. And I felt like it was handled really well in here in a way that I didn't feel like it was in Sea of Tranquility.
We didn't need to explain exactly how everything happened, but we just took it for granted, which I've got a pretty healthy suspension of disbelief. So I kind of rolled with that. And again, it was a page turner. I didn't get too caught up. It's for pleasure, right? So maybe I don't look at it with the same kind of critical eye. But I don't know that I necessarily share Craig's vision. I do think that we're kind of the train's on the tracks here. I don't know that it's going to be 40 years until this stuff happens, but we're doing bad things at a pretty rapid pace. And this is all fairly plausible to me.
Yeah. And another thing that I think was interesting is, so I think the world building, usually for me in sci-fi world building is a really big deal. I didn't think there was a ton of world building here because it seemed close enough to our current world for us to imagine it. But I think the really interesting part of the world building was that huge famine, the Great Starvation. I think something that I think, it wiped out like 2% of the population or 200 million. That's a pretty key component in changing the trajectory of the world that we see in this book that I think we can't really account for. So while I feel like we can understand this world to an extent, trying to imagine, I mean, even if we think back to what the world was like in 2018 or 2019 before COVID, even something like that altered, the course of humanity and the course of evolution. And then if we're talking about something like an entire famine, global starvation, that is a really big deal. So I think that anything in this book that doesn't feel totally plausible, like even the 6 feet of water in Lower Manhattan, which I agree with you, Craig. I feel like that was to make it an action sequence with him climbing the building. Yeah. I was like, okay, this is unnecessary.
That was the diehard portion of our book.
Yeah, it was so unnecessary. But like, I do think that the world feels plausible. And then, but there is still a hint of like, well, who knows? Because there's been a, starvation over the course of, 10 years? 15? I don't remember.
Yeah, but, I don't remember.
Yeah. Pretty major event.
Well, I think whether we agree with Craig or not on whether we like to read about apocalyptic futures or hopeful futures, that certainly is the author's, this certainly is the story, I would say. We are doomed. We are on our way to being doomed, whether we like Kara's way or Logan's way.
Yeah.
Right? What we all agree on is that we're doomed. So what's
No.
I'm not saying everyone in this room agrees that.
Okay, so
I'm saying in the book, both sides agree that we're doomed.
They both know they're doomed.
I will go back and I think the redeeming grace of this book, and I'm going to repeat, this was part one as he was changing and he was realizing that he was changing. I find that deeply interesting. Like when he would notice that other people we're moving inefficiently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, though, because it also reckons back to something that I found completely unplausible in that Edwin was reading a printed newspaper while he was in the glass cube, and he was upset because Edwin was folding the paper awkwardly.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a minute, this is supposed to be 30 or 40 years from now, and this dude's got a Washington Post that he's folding up. That doesn't seem plausible to me.
Yeah,
slightly anachronistic. Well, maybe.
But the concept that he was disturbed by the inefficiency of his motions and the fact that he was, and that talking to people that weren't upgraded like he was,
right,
was difficult because it was like talking to a teenager.
Yeah.
That was deeply interesting.
Yeah. He said like a 10-year-old.
Or
like
a 10-year-old,
speaking so slowly. Yeah.
That's really, really interesting. Yeah. But the parts of it that fall down were like the newspaper, or he was for some reason infatuated with the types of guns, like the gun that he carried into the last action sequence. Why not just say it was a gun?
Yeah, like who cares?
Yeah, there were some details that were oddly weird.
Just,
that's weird. A lot of that. Someone once, some science fiction writer was once asked, "What is the golden age of science fiction?" And his answer was 12.
Oh, yeah.
And so
it's when it's great. That, I'm right, still a 12-year-old. Right. I'll admit that. Right.
And so I think there's a lot of stuff in this kind of book that is just, I mean, you got to get the sciencey stuff in, right? I mean, and I can do without a lot of that. I can just kind of accept. I mean, that's where I am in favor of Emily St. John Mandel's approach, was just let's just throw
more
that
airy
in there and don't worry about how the science all works.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about the upgrade. Who in this room would like to have that upgrade?
See, I feel like that is a question that is hard to think about unless we consider, would you want to live in a world where everyone else has this upgrade? Right. My answer is no to both. I don't want the upgrade, and I don't want to live in a world where people have this upgrade.
I am totally in agreement with you. It's like a race to the top of the bottom, or the bottom of the top. I don't know. It's just like, everybody's getting the next. My God, it's bad enough trying to keep up with the Joneses in our world today. I can't imagine what it would be like if we had to do it genomically.
Yeah. And another interesting thing about this upgrade that I was wondering throughout, like, most of the book was, does this upgrade bring everyone to equal, or does it enhance your natural abilities? And it seems as though it enhances natural abilities. Like Kara, she'd served in the military, so she was naturally athletic. So she was just still more athletic than Logan after the upgrade. He didn't become, I mean, I think for all intents and purposes, they were trying to make him into a superhuman, which wasn't very, this whole superhuman idea was not interesting to me. But I think it is an interesting concept to think of, like, okay, if anyone gets this upgrade, we're not all going to, it's still not going to be equal. It's still not going to be equitable. It's just going to be like, if I was bad at math before the upgrade, I'll be better, but not as good as.
But not interested in it. You might be able to be great at it, but if you weren't interested in it,
then it's a good point.
Maybe not.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. I feel like I still wouldn't get the upgrade, but but I think with that caveat, it might be a little more tasteful, but it's still just like, you're right. Keeping up with the,
Towards the end, at the end of the book, when Logan had sprung his own upgrade, no one was ever upgrading their love. I mean, I want the upgrade that makes me better at love.
So would you take Logan's upgrade?
No, I don't like any of them, frankly.
Well, but the end upgrade was to be more compassionate and empathetic.
Yeah, right.
I guess.
I still didn't like that. I think that's almost worse than what Kara was going to do, because he didn't tell anyone. Didn't he upgrade the entire human population without their consent?
He did.
But he said it was okay.
He put the acid in the water supply.
Yeah. I don't know. That made me so mad. Like, after he fought Kara tooth and nail, and then he's like, oh, you know what? I can do this upgrade because this is a good one.
Well, that's hubris.
I'm like, says who?
Yeah, that's like really hubris.
And that was part of the problem I had with Miriam, too. I thought she was so selfish. Like, I don't even know. Ken, you said earlier that her gene editing was probably well-intentioned. I don't think she cared about the issue in, like, the rice fields. I think she wanted to test her upgrade. I think she wanted to test on something with a tangible outcome that she could easily reproduce, so, like, insects in a farm. And then it caused a worldwide extinction event. And then she was like, oh, let me try again. So I don't know. I thought Miriam was so selfish. I couldn't stand her. I don't know why. I didn't like her.
I got to agree with you on that. Yeah. I'm 100% in agreement. It seemed like it was all about her.
Yeah, I agree.
Every villain is like that, though. I think most, if not every villain, has good intentions, right? Well, she had good intentions. I think she looked at the 2% famine is spillage. Like, we're going to...
Well, yeah.
You got to break some eggs if you're going to make an omelet.
That's what Kara thought.
That's what Kara thought,
right?
Mm-hmm. But that was like a 13% or like... Yeah.
So they're still upping it, but you can rationalize that if it's for the best.
Yeah. That's what Kara said. She was like, yeah, I can still sleep at night. Or it'll keep me up at night, but this is for the greater good. Which... according to who? according to Kara and Miriam?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The rationalization of collateral damage has led our society in very, very bad directions for the most part of our history. So maybe we should just be really careful about that.
Yeah. And it's like, if you consider your part, or what if you're the collateral damage? Is this still okay?
Or a family member.
Yeah, right? Like, or is the collateral damage those faceless people that, you know, the 10,000 faceless people that we are like, oh, well, you know, it'll happen to them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and we certainly don't know whether Logan's upgrade had any bugs in it either, right? I mean, I know his beta test went well.
Yeah.
He at least beta tested.
I think his second upgrade was extremely unbelievable. Like, just next level unbelievable. Which, at the point that happened in the book, I'm with you, Craig, by, like, part three, I was like, okay, this is fully now just, like, an action flick.
Yeah.
So by that point, I was like, whatever, yeah, fine, make yourself a superhuman. Let's see where this goes. But yeah, like, we don't, I think for the amount of information we got about all the other upgrades, the amount of information about Kara, because it seems like Kara also tampered with her upgrade at some point.
She did.
Because she was, like, dodging bullets like Neo in The Matrix.
Right.
That's what it was like.
Like, right. Literally.
Steve, I was thinking about that and thinking about you were going to be here and wondering if we could get through one of these shows without mentioning The Matrix.
Oh.
All goes back.
Never.
It all goes back to The Matrix.
It does.
Yeah. So let's talk about the upgrade and whether we would take it. Let's talk about whether it's morally right. I mean, do we have a right to do this kind of thing? Do we have an obligation to do this kind of thing if we can? Is this playing God? Is this really what the next step of evolution is? I mentioned Harari earlier and one of those epigrams where he says Homo Deus is the next step in evolution. Is it inevitable?
There's a reason when you go to the grocery store, you buy that milk that says no GMOs. I mean, I just think this is, you start playing with genes and it's a slippery, slippery slope. It scares me more than about any, well, artificial intelligence scares the crap out of me, but gene play, that really is.
Yeah. So that's actually really interesting. So they were describing, Miriam's Scythe tool, which allows, like, for gene editing. But then the GPA developed Mystic, which was gene AI, like predictive AI using genetics, which I thought was even worse.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I was like, how is Mystic okay? Like, the reason that guy was apprehended at the airport was because he was said to have, like, the, you know, something from the Scythe gene editing software. And then they were like, oh, let's use Mystic. And I was like, well, that's the same thing as Scythe. Like, why is it okay to use gene AI but not, like, gene engineering?
Because,
like,
they were the government.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea. And he did talk about DARPA. If they could get a hold of a genetically modified human, that they would use it for all kinds of bad things. Well, heck yeah, they would. That's what they do.
Yeah, but I'm with you, Craig. The answer is no on all accounts. I just, like, no, I don't think it's our place to tinker with genes. And I think that humans might be the only species dumb enough to think that we can and think that we're all powerful. And, like, just because you can, like, does that mean that you should? But then on the other hand, I thought what was also interesting was, like, but can we also just do nothing? So, like, what do we do? Editing genes, playing with, like, the makeup of our genetics and trying to, like, alter the course of evolution by altering our genes, probably not our place. But at the same time, if we're barreling towards disaster, do we just...
It's easy for us to say, no, that's bad because we're healthy and we don't have Lou Gehrig's disease or something like that. Whereas if you did, you would go, I'll do the gene editing if it saves my life. Okay. Yeah. But it is sort of playing God.
Yeah. Well, on a personal basis, I think that's different. Like, if you opt in.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Then that's different because that only affects you, possibly. But yeah.
Yeah. Steve?
It would be interesting if they had separated a test group and the control group. Hmm. And then if the dum-dums somehow rose up and found that they were actually superior in that. And but that's kind of where I thought it was going.
Yeah.
I also thought maybe a Flowers of Algernon or
Algernon
type scope there, where he was going to get dumb again, and it would have worn off.
Yeah.
And he would have maybe at that point understood that that was not the way to. I was waiting for some sort of moral kind of light bulb to go off.
Yeah.
That never happened.
I was also wondering, like, where are the side effects of this? It's like, okay, great. I can become superhuman. I can climb buildings in Manhattan. What's the drawback? And so I kept waiting for like for a minute. I was like, he's just now like Superman. Like, what are the side effects? Like, does your heart grow too fast and you have sudden cardiac arrest episode? Like, what is?
Yeah. One of them was emotional detachment.
Oh yes. They lost the ability to feel things deeply. Yeah.
Well, did he lose the ability to feel things deeply, or did he just gain the ability to compartmentalize his feelings?
I think he just could compartmentalize his feelings. Like, he would mention turning something off and turn, like when he saw his ex-wife with the new guy she was dating, he had to turn off his feelings of like jealousy or rage to go back to his hotel and upgrade himself in the bathtub.
Yeah, right.
Wow, that's a good way to put it.
So Christine, you pointed out that when Logan arrested Dr. Romero, the mysterious and kind of evil Dr. Romero, the torturer Dr. Romero, he said, Romero says, "I know you're trying to do the right thing, but you can't put this knowledge back in the box." And I guess that's my follow-up question to the last one is, I mean, this is all stuff, this is not, I mean, obviously this is bioengineering technology that is far, far beyond what we can do today, but we certainly can tamper with DNA. There, you know, we certainly know how to build crops that only respond to Monsanto pesticides, right?
Literally.
So, is this sort of thing inevitable?
God, I hope not. Here's the problem: it breaks down when we try to let's say we can biogenetically enhance humans. Who makes the decision as to what a good human is versus a bad human? Because the reality is, the rebels of our world, the disruptors, the people that do weird stuff, the artists, the musicians, the ones that got kicked out of the club, are the ones who actually make stuff happen in our society. And if we just go to some weird homogeneity as far as human beings are concerned, that may actually be the downfall of our society, because we'll have gotten rid of the people that actually make things happen as we move forward and get better. That's the scary part. Who makes the decision as to like what the perfect human is?
Yeah. And I think that that's something that was on my mind, too, is like we have evolved to this point. And even though things feel crazy, there is a balance, and like it's an ecosystem, and changing one thing can have massive effects. So, like, I don't know. I'm unfortunately, Kara was like, "You can't do nothing." I feel like I would have just done nothing. I'm like, well, I'm going to do nothing. Like when he destroyed the upgrade, I was like, yes. And then in the epilogue, he was like, "Oh, so I did release an upgrade." It's like, no.
Well, we haven't been doing anything for the last 10,000 years. And the reality is, despite all the shortcomings that we have in our world and in our society, it's still better than it was 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's still better than it was 100 years ago. So doing nothing has gotten us here. And potentially doing nothing will get us through the next 100 years. Ideally, we'll come up with solutions to the problems which face us, which there are serious problems. But I really feel like this concept that somehow we can engineer ourselves out of it by changing our DNA is not good. We can engineer ourselves out of it, but not by tinkering with the God elements of our own physical being. That's the part that scares me.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that evolution drives people, not necessarily the other way around. It might be a little bit of give and take on both ends, but I think we can't sort of change the course of humanity and evolution by first changing ourselves. I think it happens
the opposite way.
And I think if we do try to change or evade the course of evolution, it catches up. I think it keeps score. Like even the COVID vaccines that evolved, the strains of COVID that evolved to evade vaccines is like, I mean, that happened in the course of like one calendar year on a relatively like, it's not simple. COVID's not simple, but like imagine like what our bodies would do if we changed absolutely everything and hopped off the course of nature that we're on. Like, what are the ramifications of something like that?
Yeah, they don't get into that.
No, not at all.
I think Mother Nature is undefeated.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at what Logan wanted to do was kind of anti-Darwinistic in that he wanted to have the compassionate survive. And,
right.
And in his ideal world, I guess everybody's giving each other a Coke and, you know, just in a hug, and then we're all going to be okay.
Yeah.
But inevitably, I think Mother Nature is going to find a way to put that pebble in our shoe and make it really uncomfortable to the point where it's unbearable. And then the people that can survive limping are going to persevere.
Yeah.
And compassion fatigue is like a thing. That's a real thing. From what I've heard with like healthcare workers, you just have to develop some sort of like blocker to the constant feelings of compassion and empathy, because otherwise you'd never be able to function. Mm-hmm. Like, how could you go in to your job at the hospital every day knowing like, okay, today I get to help someone else die, you know, or today I have to have 100% of my compassion and feelings for every single patient I see. It's not possible. I think even with this, even with the upgrade proposed at the end of this book, it's still not possible.
Yeah. And Christine, to kind of circle back to your idea about doing nothing, you pointed out that our character, it wasn't Logan, was it the other guy who was reading The Stranger?
Oh, yeah. That was the guy that was apprehended at the airport.
Yeah, right.
Henrik.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, too. I thought it was really interesting that you pointed that out, and it made me go back because I also noticed that he was reading Never Let Me Go, which is any of you familiar with Never Let Me Go, the Ishiguro book about the, basically it's like clones who are being raised to, you know, for their organs later. And
I'm supposed to read that, but yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
it's a great book.
Okay.
And then he was also reading Gödel, Escher, Bach, and Eternal Golden Braid, which he had tried a couple of times to read.
And couldn't get through.
And I have tried it at least a couple of times to get through that book and never been able to get through it. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, why do you think he used The Stranger?
So at first I thought it was in relation to like, so I had never read The Stranger. I didn't read it. I just read the summary. So my understanding of The Stranger was there's this guy who his mother dies. He feels nothing, no compassion, no empathy. The next day he like goes out on a date with this girl, and then his neighbor is like, hey, can you help me with this like human trafficking scheme? And the guy's like, yeah, sure thing. I got you. Meanwhile, he fails to feel any sort of feelings for his neighbor who's lost his dog, and the dog was like bought by or adopted by like his wife or something. So like just appears to be this guy that has no moral compass, right? He lacks the empathy to feel. Then he's on trial for murder and is convicted. And then he's like, well, this is okay because there's no hope for the future. There's no point to the world. There's nothing beyond the physical world. So he was comforted by that, which at first I thought that like, okay, so we've got maybe Logan and Kara are supposed to be like the two sides of this. Like, is Logan callous for not wanting to do anything, or is Kara being more callous for wanting to mass release an upgrade that will wipe out a good portion of people? But then at the end of the book, I realized when I was like writing the questions and sort of going back through and answering my own questions, I think it was actually more about the compassion element. and the lack of compassion demonstrated by the main character and the stranger. And then that wasn't like the first few pages of the book, tying into the very end of the book where he's created this world where everyone has this ability to feel compassion. So that's why I think he included it. My first thought was more along the lines of like the absence of any morality, but I don't think either Logan or Kara lack morality. I think it's just differing views.
Yeah, interesting. Anyone else have a thought about that? Anyone else a Camus fan?
It's been a long time since I've read The Plague. Yeah. Isn't that Camus?
Uh-huh.
I think so.
Yes. All right, well, let's move along then. So, Christine also asks a very pointed question. Are we, and as human beings in our denial, the greatest threat to our own survival?
Yes.
Yes.
Steve, we're two for two.
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely agree.
Yeah. I mean, I think even on an individual basis, we're the greatest threat to our own survival, right? Like, it's like, oh, I've been having chest pains for 6 years. I'll continue to ignore it until I drop dead.
Yeah.
I think this is like human condition where it's like, yeah, each of us, I think, denies so many things that need dealing with because it's hard and difficult and uncomfortable. And then we maximize that to a global scale. And I think that's our undoing is denial.
But if you could help everybody address that, wouldn't we be better off? I mean, that's what kind of Logan and Kara are saying, right?
I mean, I still don't think so. I think that I actually think denial, this is probably just because I am heavily in denial often, but I think denial can be healthy. We can't do everything at once.
Right.
We can't care about everything. We can't take care of everything. So I think denial is some sort of a survival mechanism to like, okay, I can't handle this large problem, but, you know, maybe I can get my chest pain checked out. So I think denial can be healthy. To an extent, but I think that the extent to which I feel denial and what it seems that the world, our world and the world in Upgrade feels denial is probably that's what's going to end us, I would say.
Well, the solution for denial is relationships. Like, yeah, I would deny that I had chest pain for 6 years, but my wife would go, you're having chest pains. You need to go to the doctor.
Yeah.
So our solutions for denial is that collective agency that we have when we gather together with other people. You can't continue to deny your problems when your friends are pointing them out to you. So that's society, essentially.
Possibly. I think that's a certain kind of person, though. I think that could come down to personality type. Like, I love my friends and family, but I'm probably not going to take on their problems, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's some people are more helpers. I don't know, which that's fine. I think that's the whole point. Like what you were saying earlier about like we all have different strengths and weaknesses and bringing everyone up on the same upgrade is going to create more problems. I think we're perfectly balanced. But yeah, I mean, there are lots of people that your community is supposed to help you through moments of denial and struggle. Theoretically.
Well, if we've progressed over the last 10,000 years, it had more to do with society and the collection of humans than any individual human himself. So.
I also think Miriam was in denial. I think she was literally, I think, the one that said that quote about denial being our greatest threat to survival and the greatest threat to humanity. I think she said that, like, after she released that starvation GMO that like ruined everything or like right before. But I think she was the one that said that. And then later she turned around and said like, you know, Logan, nothing goes according to plan in life. It's okay. Just be happy with whatever you can achieve. Hmm. Which this coming from the lady who caused an extinction level event.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah.
she was ego-driven because she faked her own suicide so that she could continue to do illegally the things that she was doing that caused the death of 200,000 people.
While her son went to jail. That's what I couldn't do. I could not, like, I don't know.
I think Miriam was a sociopath.
Yes, so, I think she's the antagonist. She's the villain.
I was just
going to
ask Steve that. Is she the antagonist of this book, Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. And I applaud Crouch for making a woman the supervillain. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was very progressive, right? There's not a lot of female supervillains.
Well, he twice almost over. Always does. I think. That's what he always does.
Oh, so it's a thing.
But twice over, because Kara, her daughter, was like her adjunct supervillain.
Yeah.
It's like they were both.
Her little minion. Yeah. So I think that was really interesting. So having read a lot of Crouch's writing, the family relationships the family relationships he chooses to include are usually really pointed. There's always, this is probably semi-autobiographical about his life. There's always a teenage daughter. He probably has a teenage daughter. And there's always like a wife or ex-wife that he loves, but it's like a fraught relationship. So there's always that level. But what was interesting is he included a deceased twin brother and the dad who'd committed suicide.
Yeah.
And the brother who died of a sickness, which I don't think it was ever said what that sickness was.
It wasn't.
So it makes me think, why would he include, knowing how careful he is about including familial characters, why did he include Raz, the father, and Max, who is dead?
I thought Max was going to appear at any time.
Yeah, I think that could have been plausible by the end of the book.
I really did. I didn't think he was actually dead.
He could have come up out of the waters of Manhattan.
And so I guess, I mean, you know, that I have to say both of those characters, Max more than Raz, bug me.
Yeah.
But maybe it was just a red herring.
I mean,
I couldn't find any other meaning.
I invented a theory.
I like your theory.
That's baseless, but this is what I've got. I think Max was probably, so I think Miriam, this upgrade was her life's work. I don't think you wake up one morning after causing a global starvation and say, you know what, I'm going to upgrade all of humanity. I think this was her entire life's work. I even have suspicions that maybe she slightly upgraded herself as well and her kids. That's what I think. She seems to me like the kind of person that would upgrade her children without their consent. I feel like she upgraded Max first because he maybe showed the most potential. And he died. His sickness, the symptoms weren't explained, but the people that died of the upgrade in that, not Billings, Montana, Glasgow, I don't know.
Glasgow.
The small city in Idaho or Montana. Those people also got sick and died. So maybe Max died. And then I feel like the father knew what was happening and what her plan was. So he probably offed himself because he was like, I can't deal with this lady. And then I think she then chose Logan and Kara because I think she knew since Max died, she probably needed two more subjects that had her genes. I even think she maybe upgraded herself before she had kids. So she knew that they would be like smart or capable in some way, even though I think it was frequently alluded to that Logan like wasn't super smart.
He was a disappointment.
Yeah, literally. I think I also looked up the meaning of their names. I think Logan meant hollow, which is so sad. And Max meant like ultimate or maximum, basically.
Right.
I think I don't remember what Kara meant, but I don't know. I think something happened with the family much earlier on because I think it would be interesting. Like when this, of all the things he chose to include that maybe didn't add to the novel, like the type of gun brought to the, you know, final shootout in Manhattan. That's one thing, right? Like we can see that is just supposed to fit into the action movie sequence. But like, why include deceased family members unless they have something to do with it? That's my crazy theory.
What was Miriam dying of when she decided to kill herself?
She had some kind of cancer.
Time.
But really? maybe I just made that up.
But why wouldn't she genetically fix that if she?
I think she upgraded herself to death. I think she did. I think she realized like, okay, I've done every upgrade I can, and this is miserable. Maybe she had experienced all the side effects and symptoms, and it sounds like she hadn't really been dead for that long when they found her. So the fact that she it was like that urgent that she couldn't even wait. Maybe she didn't want to face her kids after what she'd done.
The point about Max is actually really interesting because you're right. He could have been a test subject,
mm-hmm.
and she might have told her husband, and that's why he killed himself. So I don't know.
I think you have given some screenwriter some interesting possibilities.
I know, you should be a showrunner for the miniseries.
Yeah, they can call me. You can find me on Twitter. No, I'm not on Twitter. I can't be found anywhere.
Well, so we have had a lot of kind of interesting and kind of opinions all over the place about this book. When it comes right down to it, Steve Woods, you going to recommend this?
I would, yeah. I mean, just from a like I said, a page-turner type thing. If you turn that last page and you have questions, I think the author did their job. If it evokes discussion, that's a good book. You may not love it, but if it whiles away an evening over a couple drinks, then that's a success.
Yeah.
So yes.
Yeah. Christine.
I didn't love it though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same. Totally agree. I didn't love it. I think, like you've said, Steve, and like Craig has said, the first part of this book was the best. The more action-y it got, I think the less interested I was, but I still couldn't put it down. So much so that one day I was reading all day, and then I had to stop because I've had people coming over. I couldn't bear to put the book down, so I bought it on Audible so I could listen to it like while I was cooking and cleaning. Hmm. So yes, I would recommend it. It's entertaining. It's fun. I also think it's accessible. I think that's important to note as well. Like I said, I think it feels very YA, to me at least. So I think it's an accessible, enjoyable, fun book that makes you think. The characters are relatively integral. I think the characters are actually the strongest. I think they're quite interesting. So yes, I would recommend it, but I didn't absolutely love it.
Yeah. Craig.
I would agree. I mean, part one, read thoroughly, ingest. Part two, start skimming. Part three, speed read.
Or download it on Audible.
Or download,
and
yeah,
listen to it while you cook.
I mean, but you're right. Steve's right about, like, if, and I'm still thinking about it. Albeit, I just did finish it today.
Well, sure.
but I'm still thinking about it, and that's like anything. I mean, movies or whatever. If I'm thinking about it the next day, I know it was good. If I can't remember it the next day, it wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. But yeah. This one sticks. It'll be a great movie. It'll be an interesting movie because I'd like to see what somebody else would do with the story from a screenwriter standpoint.
Yeah.
Don't make it into a miniseries.
Yeah.
Please don't.
I totally agree. There's not enough substance there for a miniseries.
No.
Yeah, I would agree with all of you. I think of this kind, for this kind of a novel, it was really good. I mean, a lot of times these kinds of action science fiction novels don't have a lot of interesting thought behind them. They're just kind of, space opera type things. But this one, I mean, I love that there were actually, we were actually dealing with weighty questions in that, and I respected that. So, and especially as something that's a fast read, I thought it was good for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's also a good book that someone who doesn't like sci-fi would still enjoy this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So mm-hmm. Even Steve said you're not usually a sci-fi person. So I think if it's a sci-fi book, if it's a genre book that anyone can enjoy, that's a good sign.
Yeah. Well, Steve, what kind of person are you? what kind of book would you have to recommend to our listening audience?
That's a great question, Ken. Thank you. When we were talking about this, I wasn't going to recommend it, but it kind of reminded me when we talked about that spillage concept. Malcolm Gladwell has a book called The Bomber Mafia, and this general, I think it's George LeMay, it's Bombs Away LeMay, talked about just carpet bombing versus pinpoint bombing, and this was all kind of played out in World War II. I think what LeMay did would be the upgrade type example that he thought he could end the war very quickly and save countless lives on the U.S. side. Hmm. So very, very good book, Malcolm Gladwell, Bomber Mafia.
Yeah, thank you. Craig, what do you think?
So I'm finishing up on audiobooks. The guy who plays in Parks and Recreation, who plays the
Nick Offerman.
Nick Offerman's autobiography, which is actually very interesting. And then a dear friend of mine gave me Bono's autobiography a couple of days ago, so I'm going to go on to that one next. So I'm going, I'm into autobiographies.
Yeah. Mm. Is that the one where he reveals that he's pals with Jeff Tweedy and George Saunders or something like
I'm
that?
Oh, I'm sure he's definitely dropped some names.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure that happens in that.
Yeah, great, great.
But I'm more interested in the early studio work and the things that they were doing in the studio from a creative standpoint than what happened later on in his life, frankly.
Yeah, interesting. Christine, what are you going to recommend?
Yeah, so I don't know if this is against the rules, but my recommendation would be an earlier Blake Crouch book, Dark Matter. I love Dark Matter. It's a book that I think about like once a week, and I read that book 2 years ago, and I cannot stop thinking about
Dark Matters.
So it's about, I don't know how much time we have left, but it's about sort of exploring the path you didn't take. So it's this famous scientist who had the potential to be very high achieving, very famous, and his partner, and they split off their project because the main character wanted to pursue a home life with his wife and daughter, of course. And so he is constantly thinking about what would have happened if I would have done the other thing. And so this book gets into how can you possibly revisit a future that you didn't choose. But it's not like a doom and gloom future. It's really not future. It's more multiverse than future. Really good. Yeah. I think if you like the heady first part of this book, you'd love Dark Matter.
That's right. Yeah, I think I may pick that one up.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, so I was thinking about Upgrade and the world where bioengineering has gone haywire, and I made me think of Margaret Atwood's Mad Atom trilogy. Have you read those, Christine?
No.
They're really good. They start with Oryx and Crake.
Okay.
The second one was The Year of the Flood, which I thought was really, really good. They're really good.
Okay.
But what I really, my favorite kind of bioengineering gone sideways is a novel by Jeff Vandermeer called Bourne, B-O-R-N-E. And you might be familiar with Annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
That was the start of another trilogy that he did that was made into a movie. That's also, so there's a lot of kind of weird biological stuff going on in Annihilation and in those three. That's called the Southern Reach trilogy.
Okay.
But Bourne is kind of set in a different future where just it's gone like bioengineering gone crazy. And it's actually created, kind of a paradise, kind of a weird biological paradise. One of the characters is a giant flying bear. and as weird as that sounds,
that is not what I thought you were going to say.
Right. I know. And when you hear that, you go, well, why would I ever want to read that? Well, it is just a beautiful and really good book. And Jeff Vandermeer is a really good writer. And you could do worse than read anything Jeff Vandermeer has written. But Bourne is really good. So that about does it for us. You can find notes for this and all of our shows in the Radio Free Book Club blog on medium.com. You can also follow us, drop us a note on Facebook, stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Our show is produced by the amazing Oreo Jones for 99.1 WQRT-LP in Indianapolis. For Christine Hudson, Steve Woods, Craig Von Dalen, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening. And join us next month when we'll be puzzling our way through Benjamin Labatut's When We Cease to Understand the World. Until then, read a book.